Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi there, this is Kevin Lindsay, co-host of the Systems and Cybernetics podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, it's my pleasure to be in conversation with Dr. Tyson Yunkaporta about his book, Sand Talk, How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World. Although it is not described as such on the back of my paperback edition, Sand Talk is definitely a systems thinking book. Readers will recognize themes like nonlinearity, the space between nodes in a system, interconnectedness, complexity, and those patterns that connect. Most of the authors we talked to on this channel have built upon the work of 20th century, primarily European and American, systems thinkers and cyberneticians. In Sand Talk, Tyson Yunkaporta stands on the shoulders of the original systems thinkers, elders, the keepers and teachers of ancient knowledge, to show us that by emphasizing community and connection over individualism and fragmentation, and by cultivating respect for the land, we can address the urgent challenges we face. Each chapter of this book includes some sand talk, invoking an Aboriginal custom of drawing images on the ground to convey knowledge. The table of contents is a beautiful compilation of Yunkaporta's sand talks. I cannot do it justice here, so I'll leave it to readers to explore it on their own. Tyson Yunkaporta is an arts critic and researcher and a member of the Apalach clan in far north Queensland. He carves traditional tools and weapons and also works as a senior lecturer in Indigenous knowledges at Deakin University in Melbourne, Australia, one of my favorite cities, by the way. Welcome, Tyson, and thanks for joining me.
Hi, how are you doing, Kevin?
I am great. It's, again, such a pleasure to be talking to you today. So to start our conversation, I'd like you to share a bit of your story and tell us about what led to your current work and the writing of this book.
It's just the work of your life and the way you live, from day to day. A lot of the things I'm talking about are just, there aren't these layers of abstraction built into the stack, of your lived culture and your lived reality. So there isn't really meta language for a lot of the things I'm trying to talk about, trying to find ways of inducting people into that, but without sort of doing too many layers of abstraction. So the best way to do that is in those traditional modalities of, story and image and, a sense of dialogue, a sense of yarning, and a sense of relation, so that's what I, constantly referring to the relationship between myself and the reader as us two, because that's the first pair, in a network of relations. So it's about, making sure the reader is bringing, as much information to the book as I'm bringing to it, and there's some kind of dialogue, a sense of sitting together. That's basically it, because it is a tricky sort of knowledge system to be sharing about and trying to translate. So, in that translation space, the anthropology is kind of, it's often viewing the Indigenous culture through this one lens and, seeking to explain it through different theories and systems of thought that are quite young. And it never quite gets there. But I guess this book is kind of skipping all those stages and doing it the other way. It's turning that lens back. So it's sort of viewing the world through an Indigenous lens. So it's sort of looking back at, usually where the the observation would be running in the other direction. It's kind of reverse anthropologizing it, you know, and sort of in that process of just following through, you know, the stories and thought experiments, you know, that come out from trying to translate what you might see through an Indigenous complexity lens looking at the world. It's you kind of learn about those processes, not quite by osmosis, but certainly not through declarative knowledge either. So, you know, kind of, I don't know, it's sort of, it seems to be transforming a few people, you know, in sort of this scope of not what they know, but sort of what can be known, if that makes any sense. It's kind of.
Yeah, it definitely does. And I think the experience of reading the book, I would encourage, you know, listeners to read it slowly and really try to experience it and go back to the images that you share. You talk about the, you know, the carvings and for each chapter, you open up with that and a description of the carving. And you know, I feel like I'm almost there with you. It's a very kind of physical experience. I want to be there with you. I want to be sharing in that experience with you. So I think you do a really, interesting job of conveying that and kind of bringing the reader in a very visceral way.
And it's sort of from you know, my status and level of knowledge in my community is quite low, you know, but that's this, it's such a rich and deep intellectual tradition that, you know, about the level of a teenage boy's knowledge is actually, there's a lot that you can sit with there. And it sort of makes sense to be coming in alongside, you know, somebody rather than having an expert talking to you about it. And, you know, so it's very much a novice's book. You know, because I'm a novice with complexity theory too, although, you know, I get to talk to a lot of amazing people and thinkers all around the planet in this space, which I'm not quite sure why they're interested. I just often, like, I'm just, I don't know, I feel like in the field I'm like Borat or something. Everyone's being very polite, but I'm like, where is this strange attractor, you know? yeah. So, but it's... I don't know. There's something about that, you know, rather than reading about some expert's opinion on Indigenous knowledge or, you know, pseudoscientific projections of what a Paleolithic past might have been like, you know, to like form the basis of all of the disciplines, that there is actually something concrete and foundational in sort of sitting, you know, together at a sort of 101 entry level. And just discussing universes of knowledge where there are, you know, just endless combinatorials of ideas to put together in dialogue, you know, at that basic level. It's funny, like quite a few interesting and amazing innovations come out from that.
Absolutely. Before we go too much further, I think it probably would be useful for everyone listening to this to really understand how you define Indigenous knowledge. You do that. I think early in the book, it was useful for me to hear that, or rather to read that, and just kind of understand like what I'm contemplating as I went through the book. Would you mind taking a moment to do that?
I mean, often there's that idea of Indigenous sort of meaning, you know, that sort of tribal, you know, village life, people living outside of civilization, that sort of thing, and that doesn't quite capture what our community is. And then from inside our community, there are a lot of different sort of middle class academic frames, which also don't necessarily connect with all of us as well. There are a lot of different sort of ways of trying to define this, you know, what Indigenousness is and what the Indigenous community is. And a lot of them kind of fall short. A lot of them are really just based in sort of opposition to the colonial center. You know, so it's a sort of a politicized and identitarian kind of definition of Indigenousness, you know, as being, you know, other and being other.
Right.
And that's in all of those definitions are true, but then there's more. And sort of I try to sit in this idea of, you know, that an Indigenous community is a community that still holds a memory, holds memories and patterns of what it is to live a life embedded in the landscape. You know, so there are still, you know, norms and, you know, attitudes and understandings and knowledges that are following the patterns of creation and that are in a kind of symbiosis with the landscape, you know, so they're not separated by those layers of abstraction that I talked about before. So that's kind of, where I'm coming from.
Got it. You write, recent traditions have emerged that break down creation systems like a virus, infecting complex patterns with artificial simplicity, exercising a civilizing control over what some see as chaos. And when I read that, and I, you know, read other parts of the book that maybe some of the listeners haven't had the chance to yet, but made me wonder about the emu making the hell of a mess as you described. And can you share a little bit about, you know, some of the stories and, you know, the emu, the echidna, I don't even know if I'm saying that one right, because it's not one I'm familiar with. Can you talk about that a little bit? How does it play into this, the story?
Yeah, here? Well, it kind of, I do reference some of the creation stories in there, but sort of just the parts that are relevant. I mean, there is, you know, there's a lot of discussion, of course, out there about narcissism. In the world, and it does seem to have gotten away on us, you know. And if you look at indigenous law, the law of the land, you know, a lot of our governance systems, economic systems, and all those sorts of things that are land based, they very much seem to be in place to deal with narcissists, to make sure that never gets out of check. Which sort of makes sense if you think about it from, you know, if you align that, then come alongside the idea of, you know, the commons, the tragedy of the commons, multipolar traps, how to prevent the evolution of rivalrous dynamics, you know, in human systems, you know, where somebody gains an unfair competitive advantage by polluting the commons or exploiting the commons in some way, and then everybody has to be doing that, and then it's a race to the bottom. Our culture pretty much is one that's evolved to deal with that issue, as a way to make sure that, you know, narcissists are dealt with in a way that's not just sort of banishing them or excluding them or anything like that, but actually sort of transforming them and transforming the community along with that. You know, and there are lots of checks and balances in, you know, our systems, which are so, you know, in such a profound symbiosis, you know, like in a stack, you know, with the land, you know, once again, where each layer is sort of, it's sort of mapped responsively across the previous layer and then the layer to follow, you know, so your social systems, economic systems, governance systems, everything else is just is really sort of tracking that landscape, and particularly in adaptive ways, because the landscape's always moving. So everything we're doing needs to be moving with the land. Otherwise, you end up everything kind of falls apart. So I guess the danger that was sort of recognized early on in Australia is that of, you know, individuals or, hierarchies or powerful people having interventions in the landscape or in, you know, the economy or anything else, these direct and linear interventions that are self-serving, because these always produce externalities. It's always about outsourcing that entropy to other systems, you know, further afield from your living space. And so, yeah, and that always ends up being a self-terminating algorithm. I mean, every culture, you know, it's like, every teenager experiments with drinking too much or, you know, drugs or something like that. And I guess every young culture experiments with civilization from time to time. We have had a few here. So in Victoria, where I'm living now, there are archaeological sites of, you know, permanent sedentary sort of almost like cities, where there was stone masonry and canals, aquaculture canals for farming eels, and then production lines where they were smoking eels and then exporting them right across the continent and all that sort of thing. That was just a few thousand years ago. So, everybody, when they're young, experiments with civilization from time to time. Zimbabwe did that. That's what Zimbabwe means. It's, you know, house of stone. You know, there are all those ruins there. And I mean, archaeologists still haven't really dug around and explored that. They've just kind of dismissed it and said, well, there must have been white people here at some stage thousands of years ago. Otherwise, no one could have built this. But the elders in Zimbabwe, they have that story of, you know, this experiment with civilization, which civilization is basically, like I said, it's an outsourcing of entropy. You know, you get on an infinite growth model. But of course, you run up against the finite resources thing. It's just basically a community decides to break the laws of physics by becoming dependent on growth to support these hierarchies, and therefore becoming dependent on the importation of resources. And that pretty quickly kills all the land around you and forces you to, you know, go into an empire. And everybody's experimented with it. Everybody's learned from it and moved on. Some people are still doing it. And, you know, this most recent permutation, you know, got a bit of a, got to kick the can down the road a little bit longer than usual, because generally the land and the law of the land and just the laws of physics will sort out a civilization. You know, within 500 to 1,000 years, it'll collapse that thing. You know, this one's sort of got a bit of a temporary reprieve, you know, with the fossil fuels thing, but that reprieve has meant that it's had to exponentially increase the outsourcing of entropy to the point that, you know, there are no more over theirs to outsource it to, and it's kind of everywhere. So these illusory, you know, violence-free sort of technocratic, you know, utopian bubbles that part of the world is living in and benefiting from, a very small minority of people. You know, the semi-permeable membranes around those are getting more and more permeable by the day. And, you know, those bubbles are getting smaller and smaller. And, you know, neighborhoods that used to be, you know, nice and clean and safe, and they're becoming less safe. And, you know, air that used to be more breathable is becoming less breathable. And pretty much all that entropy is coming home, along with, you know, millions of people who have been displaced by those extractive and entropic dumping sort of activities, and sort of are following their resources back to
that narcissism running exported to. My God, absolutely. I mean, I so resonated with that outsourcing of entropy. Brilliant turn of phrase that it just says so much in just a couple of words. In previous episodes, I've talked to some systems thinkers and authors who believe there's a strong need to embrace other ways of knowing. I haven't really read anything beyond that in terms of what that means and you know, what it would look like to do that. You know, Nora Bateson, who I interviewed a few months ago, I think you might know her. She talked about blind spots in current systems thinking, saying, you know, systems thinking is really probably the best we've got right now, but it's missing so much. Can you talk about the role you see Indigenous wisdom playing, perhaps in providing what you call a framework for the understandings needed in the co-creation of sustainable systems? I was really curious about that.
I mean, for a start, you know, it's not wisdom, you know, as knowledge to be extracted or information. I think a lot of people commodify it in that way. But then it's also, it's not just representation, like the idea of, you know, oh, we're going to center Indigenous voices. Like, you know, I think, you know, from my perspective, it's about, you know, utilizing appropriate Indigenous thought and Indigenous thinkers, you know. I mean, there's heaps of wisdom, you know, out there, and you can have, oh, the black man and the red man and the white man and the yellow man need to come together from the four directions and become brothers. And that's lovely and wise. And you can sort of put that on a poster on the wall. You know what I mean? And people consume that wisdom like wildfire, but it doesn't do anything. It doesn't help. You know, for a start, it's based in a very outdated sort of wrong view of like there being four biological races and all that sort of thing. So that kind of thing is like, you know, it's about what is useful, you know, and what is useful is seldom the content. I mean, unless you're extracting that content, like, you know, you're, you know, getting up, you're finding out about a plant medicine, a plant that you can extract, you know, a compound from, and then synthesize something similar, and then make, and then own that plant and own that medicine. You know, so there's that level of content, and then there's the sort of, I don't know, sort of psychotech and spirit tech of you know, just these little affordances of you know, groovy things that, you know, make people feel like they're expanding their mind and all that sort of thing. You know, these are just like, you know, people trying to sanitize little bits and pieces of indigenous knowledge into these you know, I don't know, spirit tech, psychotech of just ecstatic loops of mm-hmm. bloody, you know, breath work, or you know what I mean, so they can, you know, get a bit of joy out of that for a minute. That's all great. It's awesome that people are doing that. It's lovely that people are doing yoga with didgeridoo vibrational healing and all that sort of stuff. That's nice, but I mean, mm-hmm. that's not where I'm looking at. You know, I'm looking at knowledge systems. I'm looking at knowledge processes. I'm looking at indigenous methods of inquiry and what there is there that can be useful, you know, to add, to bring to the system. You know, like, for example, a lot of scientific method will leave out the variables of time and place in their inquiry.
Yeah.
But these are always central variables in indigenous inquiry, and they help. You know, so one example I use is the fish oil. Fish oil trials always have variable results. You know, you've always got fish oil, but you know, there's no proven link that fish oil has any health benefit because the results have been so variable in the kidney trials, etc. Because they're not including time and place as variables in that. You know, so we know, we understand that fish fat is only medicinal in a certain season, you know, in certain places and in a certain season. Like, for example, in one place, it's only medicinal when you see the yellow flowers, you know, in the trees. And that's when you harvest the fish fat. And so that's why they're getting such variable results in the trials. You know what I mean? So it's just, I mean, it's just, it's kind of common sense stuff, but stuff that clearly does make a difference. Where you don't have to take a leap of faith.
Yeah.
Where there is a measurable and immediate difference and change in your process that makes you know, what you're designing a hell of a lot more productive, efficient, complex. More importantly, to be able to see those complex patterns and make predictions, you know, that include the pattern breakers, rather than just sort of doing this patternicity all the time of, you know, observing a mechanical universe and then, you know, wanting to have that stability, you know, that doesn't really take into account irrationality, the irrational behavior of people, but also the irrational behavior of land and the universe behaves irrationally. Yeah. You know, so indigenous knowledge is good at predicting those pattern breakers and seeing the deeper pattern in those things. So, you know, all that kind of stuff. And more.
Yeah, that's so useful to me at this point. You know, having just finished the book, I was going to ask you this question around this comment you make about not seeing, you don't predict science embracing indigenous methods of inquiry anytime soon, that it's only wanted at the level of what, not how. And I think that maybe what you were just saying is the answer to that question. And that it's not about some come to the table with, you know, this indigenous thinking and help us solve this problem that we're facing right now. Come on, cough it up. It's more about the intersection of the knowledge systems. That seems to be what you're getting at.
But I wrote that before I was aware of this kind of emergent, sort of critical mass of people who are interested in that, who are interested in indigenous process. And indigenous complexity, systems thinking, all the rest. You know, there is a hunger for that out there. Like,
absolutely.
You know, for so long, indigenous knowledge has been about, you know, oh, you got to recognize our knowledge; it's actually good. You know, and then trying to convince the world that it's worth something. And I don't know. And trying to make people feel good about that and win people over. And that's what the business of indigenous knowledge, you know, as a discipline has been for such a long time. is that there is a critical mass of people now going, yeah, all right, what do you got? Show us. And then, but, you know, we've been in the business so long of just convincing people that it's worth doing. They were like, oh, hang on a minute. I need to think about it. You know what I mean?
I see.
And that's, I mean, the most important thing about Indigenous knowledge is that it's contextual. You know, so our knowledge is sitting in a set of global relations that is now, you know. So anybody who's drawing on something that's from, you know, a point of time in the past that's not recognizing what is, you know, what is important right now and what the problems are that need to be responded to right now, you know, is, well, that knowledge is, you know, it's good knowledge, but it's not what people are needing. It's not what the world is needing right
now. Right. You know, so are you still feeling the same about this sentiment that you expressed about, you know, you said you were quite careful in the writing of the book about the Indigenous knowledge that you chose to present in the book. And you said, because you know how ideas can get tangled up and twisted in the marketplace of civilization. And you write that perhaps the worst possible outcome of this work would be civilization embracing these ideas. So I was really curious about what you meant by that. And are you still thinking the same way?
It's, you know, the globalizing system that we have and this sort of rolling, massive, complex meta-crisis that's going on around the globe. You know, this has become a self-organizing, you know, dynamic, autopoetic system. You know, it's very clever. It's pretty much, I almost see it as sentient at this stage, you know, and it is very good, whether you call, I don't care what you call it, you know, liberalism, you know, the Anglosphere, you know, industrial civilization, it doesn't really matter what you call it. It's there and it's very, very smart. It's a smart civilization. You know, it's running on some pretty good algorithms, although there's a bit of a self-terminating algorithm in there as well. And it's very good at absorbing it jujitsus its way through any threat. So any idea, ideology, you know, data, understanding, anything, movement that rises in opposition to it, it's very good at absorbing it and taking on the branding of that thing. And then sanitizing it and putting it to work in service of the system, you know, and that pretty much happens with every single movement, you know, anything that could help actually stop the wheel is actually, you know, becomes grease for the wheel, if you know what I mean. And so, you know, I often see this, and there's a few things that I do in trying to translate things into metaphors, you know, I see them sort of starting to take the shape of a heuristic. And then I think, oh, man, somebody's going to take that up. Somebody's going to pick that up, and that'll be, you know, the Aboriginal 5 steps to – and it's like, oh, no, don't do it. So that's why I'm really careful. Like, I make it clear that I'm making the choice to not capitalize those things. You know, don't call them this. Yeah. Like, as soon as you give it a name, it's stuffed, it's finished.
A methodology, it's not the 5 steps.
Do not have a list of things to do to save the world. Right. Do not have a heuristic, you know, do not have a 5 parts of, you know, this or that. You know, the idea that it's just a way in and you keep, you know, just applying your own metaphors, but then switching the metaphors around. So that's why I mix it up a bit, like you could, you know, like I have you know, an elder who calls one of the processes I'm talking about respect, connect, reflect, direct, because she's into rhyme, you know.
I recall.
But I think of it personally as spirit, heart, head and hands, or, you know, also there's heaps of other metaphors there. You can do roots, trunk, branches, leaves, you know. It's about a way of moving through and making sure you're not doing things the wrong way around, which basically in the end it's about making sure you're seeing the entire system of relations before you intervene. That's all that is. And you can just tell people that.
Yeah.
But without a story or a metaphor, you know, or, you know, a process that they can sort of walk through. But then they need to transform it and make their own. Without that, the sentence doesn't mean anything. Yeah. Do not observe a system from outside of that system. And definitely do not, I mean, that's an intervention in itself, but definitely then don't act on that observation and seek to change, you know, I'm going to go in here and change this system. You know, like even people who do.
Well, and that's,
I've got a great De Bono example I can offer after.
Sure. Love him.
So I just didn't want to cut you off from what you were saying. So bookmark that.
Oh, no, I was just, I mean, there's so many things that you're saying that I want to pick up on. But I want to hear from you. I don't want to hear my
mess,
own voice.
It's such a mess, isn't it? It's a mess of ideas. And how do you navigate your way through it?
It is.
So it doesn't have to be question and answer. You can just yarn about it too, right, if you like, because it flows better like that and we find a better path through.
I love a good yarn. Now this is amazing. It's but you know, one of the things that struck me when you were talking is I was thinking to myself, you know, you probably won the battle with your publisher, who was probably wanting to say the five things to do to apply systems thinking to, you know, save the world. And the reason I say that is I loved the section on the different minds, ancestry mind, or so rather ancestor mind, kinship mind, pattern mind, those and then the comment that you make about, you know, the opportunity to use those together, and the relationship between different systems was just so you know, and for me, I've spent my whole career as a product marketer. So I love things like that. I love things that I can kind of take. And
did it, yeah. I don't know, did it work? Did it destroy it for you a bit when I took them all, mapped them onto a hand, and then closed the hand into a fist and just crushed them all together? Did that kind of, did it break it down a bit?
Not really. I did not want to leave it, you were sticking your head, man. I understood what you were doing. I'm so worried
about the marketing that, I mean, I didn't win the battle with the publisher. My original title for the book was Forever LTD. And that was a joke from the book about, you know, they'll take this stuff, this forever knowledge, and then, forever limited. They'll sanitize it and then corporatize it. They'll take these things and then it'll become a consultancy. Then it'll become like a Black McKinsey, and then we're finished.
I completely hear you, and going totally off script here. And I have so many good questions I want to get to, but on that one, I this has been my big question with this book is, well, what do we do with this? Because the book has excited me, and it has made me, it's inspired me to think about how, how I can bring this, how I can help you with this message, or how I can bring it to my work. And so I kind of feel like if you don't do it, someone else will, like you said. And so is there a way? Plenty of people are.
But then plenty of people are not as well. And they're the ones who are doing amazing things. Plenty of people are trying to capture bits of the book and do something with it. But these are just little islands of death that don't go anywhere. Is it not enough just to be excited in the world and to move in the world with that excitement?
Maybe I'm not there yet. Maybe that's the adolescent in me. You know, I really appreciated, I was thinking, Tyson's no adolescent when I like reading
that. I am in our culture.
In the book.
We just got an older culture, so an adolescent is, a doctor.
But so maybe it's my adolescence speaking, you know, the impatience or the desire to go act on this in some way. Because I just feel like it in many ways is kind of that missing piece from so much of what we're talking about. I spend a lot of time on the
missing piece thing. There's something there. We will get back to that.
Yeah.
So you were just saying you spend a lot of time.
I spend a lot of time on Vancouver Island, up on the Canadian West Coast. It's my other home, and where I plan to be back in within a couple of years. And just the work that's happening there with our local Indigenous communities and First Nations people, and there is so much leaning in on the part of the colonizers to sincerely bring this work to the big work. And I guess that's kind of this is like, all right, no more lines, Indigenous, non-Indigenous, you're from there, I'm from here, whatever. We've got a big thing we got to fix. And so all of us need to bring all our capacities to the problem. And I guess that's kind of where I'm at.
That's exactly it. But where to look is, where the useful missing pieces are. And the useful missing pieces are the foundations of the disciplines. The stuff that a lot of really good work and rigorous work in the disciplines, like psychology, economics, everything that you can think of, and especially right across the complexity sciences, particularly in, you know, game theory and all the rest of it, you know, there are missing pieces or wrong pieces that are more like pseudoscience in the foundational knowledge. It's in that part of the discipline that's built on the idea of when we were cavemen, you know, that idea of going, okay, so we're going to explain human behavior, you know, from an evolutionary perspective, based on our projections of what Paleolithic life must have been like, you know. So there are lots of projections back. And yeah, a lot of it is poor logic. And it's really interesting when you look, it's from very smart people who would normally not stand for such threats to validity, but they just let it slide. And they actually, you know, are proponents of these things. So you hear like this idea, like if people are looking at information, you know, information theory, different theories of information, data, all these kinds of things, you know, they'll talk about, oh, you know, yeah, as human beings in cavemen, you know, used to have an oral culture. And, you know, the problem with that was the problem of Chinese whispers. You know, one person would say, you know, pass on the story, and then the next person would slightly change it and pass it on to the next. And eventually you don't have an accurate thing. Now we have ways to store information accurately, you know, and empirically to share the truth. And it's just like, that's just what they imagine. That would be like, as a person who is, I don't know, what would be the word for orality? But it's illiterate, who are illoralate or something, you know, people who have really poor oral literacy. That's what happens for them when they pass on messages. They get garbled. You know, but in our way, it's, you know, we have very strict things in place. You're not allowed to do anything until you can do it perfectly. For example, we have pedagogies of, you know, you have to observe until you've so inhabited the being of that master that you're observing that you are able, after so much observation, to get it right the first time. And it has to be perfect the first time. And that includes with story, ceremony, and particularly with information and knowledge about the world around you. It has to be passed on perfectly. It also needs to grow, you know, through a process of inquiry. And everything that comes in, new knowledge, it's done collectively in groups of people who are seeking constantly to falsify or verify the information and align it with all the previous information and story. So we have very, very strong and strict ways of passing on knowledge that is not Chinese whispers. And it seems to be in common, this seems to be in common, something with Indigenous people all around the world. It seems to be, you can see remnants of it in traditions, you know, through Europe. You know, the Welsh still have that in their oral traditions. You know, you can find it in parts of Scotland. You can find it over a lot of Russia. There's not many places in the world where, even in France, you'll find there are Basques. Basques in France, Basques in Spain, they still have this as well. You know, that's what Paleolithic life was like. So just on that thing, the information. But then further on the all these ideas about fight or flight, and the idea that, well, the human brain grew so big because of hypervigilance, you know, because basically, you know, cavemen didn't have much to think about. You know, they were basically just struggling to survive. And so the only way their brain grew big was, you know, by having to form close-knit social groups and being constantly hypervigilant because of predators. And that's rubbish. You know, you go be with any Indigenous community that still has a close relationship with the land, and you'll find out that those people always know where the predators are, and that no one has ever been taken by a predator, because that community is in relationship with that predator, and has such a massive seasonal knowledge and really strict and rigorous methods of inquiry that ensure that everybody knows where all the predators are all the time and will avoid those areas or have ways of approaching those predators in relation that, you know, it's not dangerous.
You know, you said something, it's reminded me of a part of the book and where you talk about turnaround and how creation is just not this thing of the past, is this co-creation that just kind of happens all the time. And it's kind of locked in these metaphors and cultural practice. That seems to be what you're talking about here. Reason. It becomes indelible, right?
Yeah, that's symbolic reasoning. It's about basically transforming tangible things into metaphors. You know, and in that action, you're moving those things across to an imaginal space or a place of spirit or a theoretical space, intangible space, whatever you want to call it. You're moving those things into there, and then you're manipulating them there to find solutions or to produce other events or combinatorials, which you then bring back. Mm-hmm. You then have to close that loop and bring it back, transfer the new metaphors back into the reality. And so you have this sort of feedback loop, between sky camp and earth camp, the tangible and intangible, theory and practice, if you like, whatever metaphor you want to use for it. And you've got that constant feedback loop happening between those worlds, and it works. And it's basically how anything good, in science or technology or anything else is doing that action anyway. What's not doing that is the mathematics curriculum in most schools. It's a reason people hate mathematics so much is that they're just being asked to sit in the abstraction, with no feedback or exchange with the tangible reality.
Yeah.
Everybody feels that as a threat to their existence. It's an existential threat. Mm-hmm. There are studies done where they ask people to draw pictures of their maths teachers, and you'd be surprised how many of them have horns and teeth.
Monsters.
And tongues and tails. Yeah.
I bet. Mine would have been. My drawings would have definitely looked
and
like that.
It's because of that. People feel... that's where the fight or flight response comes in, when you have to sit down with your maths teacher and he's weaponizing boredom to lobotomize you into a, standardized testing consciousness. It's horrendous.
Yeah. You talk about cause and effect and these feedback loops, and obviously these are concepts that are pretty familiar to people who like systems thinking and get into that stuff. But use the phrase symbiotic dances. So when you said exchanges a couple of minutes ago, it reminded me of that, just these symbiotic dances that are needed to kind of create the sustainable responses that we have. Again, it's not like you can't spend a lot of time talking about it. We just need to invite people to read the book. But can you talk about that for a couple of minutes? Yeah. I love that.
Oh, I mean, there's heaps more metaphors for that. I could say co-evolutionary fitness surfaces. Yeah, that would do if you read up on that. Do it from another point of view, from our point of view, adaptation is, it's a team effort. It happens, across all different membranes, in the evolutionary stack, and there is interaction between those things, especially if all of those things, they don't have artificial layers of abstraction in them. Then there is a responsiveness, between your governance model and, what changes in the landscape. And the landscape changes all the time. Every ecosystem moves 100 meters a year. Most species migrate, over time, including humans. It's, everything on the planet is migrating, even continents, all the time. So if you don't move with the land, the land will move you. Everything, climate, every aspect and entity of climate is caught up in migration and disruption all the time. Mm-hmm. So there needs to be a kind of responsiveness right through your stack. So that's where the layers of abstraction in there are dangerous, because they're not responsive to land. Land has to be the mycelium of your reality. And as long as you maintain that, then you're good, because there can be cataclysmic damage to any other layer of the stack. And something will step into that niche and replace it, in the same way that you could, you could kill all the cows on a continent, all the large herbivores. But as long as you've still got the mycorrhiza and you've still got the grass in that stack at the bottom, then something will come along to, you will have some large herbivore that will very soon come and fill that niche, or will be emergent. In evolutionary terms, within that system. So I guess that's kind of how that all works. It's about responsiveness, and it needs to be You need to acknowledge that you're standing on land all the time. And here's the variable that's often lost in most of our disciplines is land. You know, and land has got to be where you're standing first. And you have to be building your cultures, your knowledge, your theories, everything on an understanding of land and on a responsiveness to a dynamic and shifting landscape. Because that's how you understand complexity, is through the land. And once you have that understanding of land, then that's a transferable skill set that can go across all your disciplines. It can go into your cybernetics and go into everything else. But those things are silos that sit here and there. They should not be layers of abstraction that are messing up our evolutionary stack. Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. Another theme that I really, I wanted more actually in the book was the whole theme of time and past, present, and future as one time. Some listeners might have listened to the very first podcast I did on this channel was a two-part interview I did with Tony Hodgson on his book, Systems Thinking for Turbulent Times. And one of the reasons why I loved it was he talks about anticipatory systems and, you know, talks about Robert Rosen and his work. But Hodgson coins this term anticipatory present moment. And then he's really also into like this idea of he has a facilitation model called Three Horizons, very much about bringing the future into the present in terms of decision making, and we're breaking down the difference between past, present, future. So I love this part, and I just wondered, you know, how you think, again, not at the, I'm so tempted to say, how do I use that? How do I this stuff that you're talking about? But how do you think about it? Just in terms of, I don't know. I mean, it's hitting the mainstream. It's hitting, you know, thinkers like Hodgson. Who may be influenced by, you know, work such as yours. So I'd love to get your thoughts on that one.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's just where it takes your thinking, you know, so that in your, especially in the foundations of things, because you might have some really good thinking models. And maybe this is a really good place to bring that De Bono example in. And then I can work back around to why it helps to, you know, just have some thought experiments around indigenous physics, you know. The physics of an indigenous worldview. You know? you know, so he was asked to use his really good lateral thinking tool to solve Middle East crisis. You know, can you resolve the Middle Eastern conflict using your,
do that,
you know,
take care of that.
And yeah, he did some really good lateral thinking, but his foundations were wrong. You know, he had bad story for his foundations, and you have to have good story, you know, and land has to be part of it. There has to be place in it. And because he didn't have that, the whole thing didn't work. So, you know, he went in and of course he starts looking at the problem. And of course the foundations of his wrong story there tell him that, you know, Arabs are the problem. Okay. And so, all right. So what is the Arabs' problem? Well, they're being violent. So, the problem is Arab aggression. Okay. So what are some of the things that cause aggression? And he's looking at that. And then it's like, well, vitamin B deficiency causes aggression. And, wow, I found a study that says Arabs are vitamin B deficient in these lands. And so then he says, so his solution to the Middle East conflict is we need to send Vegemite to Arabs. That was his lateral thinking solution. Because if they could just eat some more Vegemite, then they'd stop being aggressive. And then that's it. That's the whole conflict sorted. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, if there are any complexitarians out there, they will be just like, you know, almost in agony right now. They'll be having an autistic fit on the floor. Like, just about the horrendous simplicity of that. So here's where, you know, systems thinking can go wrong. Here's where any good thinking model can go wrong if you don't have good foundations.
Yeah,
and you've got to have good foundations by testing them, and you know, moving them around and actually challenging them. You know, people forget they call themselves empiricists and scientists, but you know, they forget that the most important thing there is to be constantly trying to falsify your assumptions. You know, right from the start.
Yeah,
you know, you're seeking to you know, checkmate your null hypothesis all the time. That's what you're supposed to be doing. You know. You can't just retreat into this, well, the data doesn't lie. You know, I'm an empiricist and blah, blah, blah. It's like, no. You have to do the work. And so it is good to look at, you know, indigenous ideas of physics. And, you know, so you look at, so especially with, you know, understanding observer effects and then thinking about, you know, other ways to get around that. That will sort of change your interventionist approach to how you try and do change making for a start, you know, how you conduct experiments,
yeah.
But then, you know, how you approach population health, you know, public health, things like this, anything that's a complex problem. If you've, you know, been messing around with stories of indigenous physics, you know, there might be some things of use in there, you know. So me and a friend of mine, he's a pure mathematician, works for Deloitte. So he's an Aboriginal fella who does sort of algorithms and stuff for Deloitte. And we've been playing around lately. Rick Shaw is his name. He's a Gamilaroi man, Aboriginal man. We've been playing around with this idea of Schrodinger's wombat. And so we're just sort of retelling that story because it is a story. The cat right. in the box is a goddamn story, you know. And a lot yeah. of the thought experiments, yeah. you know, are kind of translations, attempts to turn these problems or these laws even into metaphors, you know. And so we're looking at Schrodinger's mm-hmm. wombat because it doesn't really matter what's in the box. That's, you know what's in the box from the signs that you get, the information that you get from the context all around. So we're looking at a wombat in a log. And is he there? What's he doing? Is he alive? Is he dead? And then we look at the myriad of signs, seasonal signs, you know, contextual knowledge, you know, ancestral knowledge, you know, wind direction, you know, temperature, scat, and all the like 1,000 details of that scat in the place, you know, the spore, the grass, everything. Yeah. We're looking at a million things, you know, like, and the computational power needed to do that. You don't do that on your own. You do it with somebody, you know, and you're both mm-hmm. observing together. But you're not just observing together, and there's still not enough computational power. You're part of a sentient system observing itself. And once you're both together there, embedded in that landscape, in that sentient system, which is the biggest supercomputer you could imagine, and you're part of it observing itself, then you yeah. know exactly where the wombat is and you know exactly what it's doing completely. And so that kind of flips that Schrodinger's
so cool.
cat on its head because yeah. it's all they're interested in is what's going on inside the box. Not like, who the fuck poisoned this cat? We need to fire him. You know what I mean? Anyway, yeah, so they're not you know, interested in context. And it's because of that sort of
right.
you know, second law of thermodynamics. You know, this yeah. idea of enclosures and vacuums, particularly this fascination with,
yeah.
you know, having to have things, complexity break down over time when it's completely blocked off from everything else. But we know we don't inhabit systems that are, you know, in a vacuum. We don't inhabit systems
yeah.
that are not, you know, we live in vast overlapping systems and they're systems within systems. And every system is constantly, you know, dumping entropy, but that entropy is something else's lunch. So you have these beautiful closed loops where everything's recycled and it's more first law, you know, first law of thermodynamics. And that's our model of time from an indigenous point of view. And it's not a matter of defeating one law or another, you know, it's about one model of time or another. It's useful sometimes to examine something or do a thought experiment, you know, using a different model of time or a different physics, because you never know what you'll find. You know, if you're having trouble with the observer effects, uncertainty principle, a million other things, sit down and just have a wild session of thought experiment with applying Schrodinger's wombat for a minute and see what comes out of it. You might yeah. be surprised. And it doesn't mean
yeah. Yeah.
Schrodinger's wombat is the truth or it's a law or anything like that, or that it's defeated the Western model.
Yeah.
It really helps to apply different lenses. And science knows this because you'll use Newton for a bit, but then if you want your freaking satellite to work, you're going to have to switch. You know what I mean? You're going to need your Einstein for that because...
Yeah. I hear you.
Gravity and time and such. You know, science knows that you switch. You know, a theory is only good in a context and only for a certain percentage of the time. And you're supposed to switch between theories, you know, and you're constantly supposed to be adding to them, you know. So why the hell wouldn't you engage with other systems? I think it's the problem is the dichotomy where we sort of offset these things as, you know. I had a problem recently. So, you know, this memory study I did, we did an empirical study 3 years ago that was comparing the ancient Greek memory palace memorization technique to an Aboriginal songlines memorization technique. And, you know, there was a huge ceiling effect in the study. So what we could measure of difference was very small, but the Aboriginal technique did marginally better. And so, you know, I don't know, someone must have had a quota to fill recently because they dug that up and published it finally. I mean, we couldn't get funding for it, so it wasn't a very good study. And then they finally published, and out it goes. And it's gone front page, page three in Australia to start. But then it's going viral on the web because of the inflammatory headline. It's like, you know, ancient Aboriginal memory, you know, defeats the West kind of thing. Memory technique, you know, defeats Western methods. Yeah. Defeats the ancient Greeks. You know, it's like there's always this dichotomy. They've got to be offset against each other. But there's so much in common between the methods that it's like, you know, in dialogue, there's some awesome stuff.
Yeah.
You know, the memory palace way has some strengths that could actually help out the other way. And you know what I mean? So it's just inflammatory.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's everything's framed like that. So so that ensures that, you know, it always has to be, you know, science, like condemning everything else as pseudoscience or, you know, et cetera. I'm happy to be like, I mean,
exactly.
My book, it is pop science. It's freaking pop science, and you can't really call it anything else, you know. But you know, it's fun. And the most important thing is research translation and engaging the public with science in some way. You know, and you don't want to misinform
it
people,
does that.
But you do want to get people excited about it. And that's, you said you're excited and that's enough.
Yeah.
You know, you get people excited. You got to get people looking at different lenses. You got to get people you know, interested in, you know, actually, you know, the things that they're reading, the stuff that's coming to them through their algorithms, get them interested in a method of inquiry where they're attempting to verify and falsify things. And they're, you know, they're synthesizing. They're comparing, they're collating, you know, they're doing some actual rigorous analysis. And then, you know, you won't get as many disturbing trends going on.
Yeah, yeah. So this is amazing. I love this conversation. I wish we could go on longer, but we do need to wrap up. And, you know, I hope I can continue the conversation with you at another time. And so... a few things that, you know, you get to at the end of the book, we're going to leave a little bit of a mystery, and encourage people to read the book. There's some, you talk about some conversations with some elders, some questions posed to them and some of those insights. And I love them. So again, listeners, read the book, for those insights. And I love your last words, you know, your very last sentence. So let's put these hands of ours to work. And I think that we don't know all the answers. And coming out of this conversation with you, I have more questions than I had at the beginning, to be honest.
But the book doesn't give any answers. But hopefully.
No. So that's what you've accomplished.
You'll start finding some really useful new questions.
Yeah. So this has been great. I want to thank you so much for taking the time with me today. So it's been a pleasure meeting you, Tyson. Yeah.
Well, thanks for mixing it up a bit, Kevin.
So long. And so I just want to end. You've been listening to my conversation with Tyson Yunkaporta, author of the 2020 book, Sand Talk, How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Systems and Cybernetics. Until next time, goodbye.